Hello, and welcome back to our brief philosophical musings. This week, we march on to meet Epicurus. He was a philosopher today, often thought of a prophet of indulgence. In this episode, we'll discover that Epicurus was far from a luxury-seeking glutton. He was a teacher who founded a school in an Athenian garden and preached a surprisingly humble gospel of happiness, rippled through Roman times and even into the modern age.
Epicurus was born in 341 BC on the Aegean island of Samos. In his youth, Epicurus studied under philosophers, absorbing the idea that the world is made of tiny atoms rather than guided by Olympian gods. This atomic theory would become the backbone of his own philosophy, but his goal was never just physics. It was using an understanding of nature to ease human fears. After a brief mandatory service in the Athenian military, Epicurus began teaching. Around 306 BC, at about 35 years old, he settled in Athens and founded his own school known as the Garden. Unlike the grand halls of Plato's Academy or Aristotle's Lyceum, Epicurus's school met in a modest garden he owned on the outskirts of the city. There, he and his followers lived a communal life, pooling resources and welcoming anyone, including women and even slaves, who genuinely wanted to seek wisdom and happiness. This egalitarian circle of friends, sharing philosophic conversation and simple meals, was revolutionary in a society that normally excluded many from intellectual life. Inside the garden, Epicurus lived very plainly. Ancient stories tell us his daily diet was bread and water, with a bit of wine or a piece of cheese saved for special treat. Hardly the image of a decadent gourmand. In fact, Epicurus's simplicity was deliberate. He believed that happiness is easy to obtain if one learns to enjoy little and need little, and that luxury for its own sake could spoil the soul. He was fond of saying that wealth matters not so much to a person who has simple needs, and his own life proved that a quiet mind and a full heart bring more joy than a rich banquet. Epicurus is famous, or in some circles, infamous, for proclaiming that pleasure is the highest good. But what did he really mean by pleasure? Epicurus redefined pleasure to mean something much more subtle than constant merriment. For him, the greatest pleasure was not feasting and drinking, but the absence of pain and disturbance in body and mind. This vision of the good life focuses on peace of mind. Epicurus taught that we should seek pleasurable experience only to the extent that it keeps us free from suffering. The goal is to minimize harm and anxiety, not to pursue wild thrills. When we say that pleasure is the end, Epicurus wrote, we do not mean the pleasures of the prodigal or the sensual, but freedom of the body from pain and of the soul from confusion. So, a simple cup of water when thirsty, or a plain meal when hungry, could be immensely pleasurable in Epicurus's eyes, because they remove a pain and restore a natural balance. To live pleasurably, therefore, one must live wisely and moderately. Epicurus emphasized the importance of understanding our desires. Not all desires are worth chasing. He sorted desires into categories. Some are natural and necessary, like the desire for food, shelter, and friendship, which are easily satisfied and vital for happiness. Other desires are natural but not necessary, such as a craving for gourmet delicacies when plain food would suffice. These add little to our well-being and can be safely set aside. Worst are the vain and empty desires, cravings for power, fame, or endless wealth, which have no natural limit and only multiply anxiety. By training ourselves to focus on simple, necessary wants and to let go of the rest, we free ourselves from constant longing. Epicurus observed that if you need less, you will never feel lacking. A person who enjoys a crust of bread with a grateful heart is richer, in Epicurus's view, than a tyrant who covets ever more riches. Epicurus did not reject virtue. He wasn't telling people to shirk ethics and just feel good. In fact, he taught that virtues like wisdom, moderation, and justice are indispensable to attain a happy life. It is not possible to live pleasantly without living wisely and justly and honorably, he wrote, nor to live wisely and morally without living pleasantly. In other words, living a good life and living a pleasurable life amount to the same thing. You can't have one without the other. The virtuous person, who is honest and prudent, avoids the troubles that come with crime or excess, and thus enjoys a more lasting peace of mind. For Epicurus, pleasure and virtue walk hand in hand toward the goal of happiness. If inner tranquility is our greatest pleasure, then nothing undermines tranquility more than fear. Epicurus boldly targeted the two deepest fears he saw tormenting human souls: the fear of capricious gods and the fear of death. These fears, fanned by superstition, guilt, and imaginations of the afterlife, caused immense anxiety, so Epicurus set out to dispel them with clear-eyed reasoning. By studying nature scientifically, Epicurus believed, we can understand phenomena like thunder or eclipses, and thereby remove the false, terrifying stories that religion often imposed. Freeing people from fear of the gods was, to Epicurus, one of the first steps toward peace of mind. A just and wise God wouldn't torment us anyway, he argued, and any being that would, by definition, wouldn't be divine. So why be afraid? Even more personally troubling was fear of death. The thought of our own mortality, or what might come after, haunted many people then as it does now. Epicurus offered a blunt comfort. Death is nothing to us. This wasn't nihilism, but a logical reassurance. When we exist, death is not present, and when death is present, we no longer exist. As long as you're alive, you haven't died, and when you're dead, you won't be around to feel anything. So at no point do you actually experience being dead. The soul, he said, is made of atoms that disperse at death. Then we need not dread the afterlife. Epicurus allows us to enjoy life more fully. Instead of worrying endlessly about a dark future, we focus on the here and now, the real life we have, and make it pleasant. Why fear that which cannot be felt? He asked. To Epicurus, fearing one's own non-existence is as silly as bemoaning the eternity of time before we were born. It didn't trouble us then, so why should the eternity after we die cause anguish? We agree to behave decently toward each other because it's in all of our interest. It keeps us safe and at peace. This sounds a little like Richard Dawkins' teachings in The Selfish Gene, doesn't it? So, when you hear Epicurean hedonism, don't think of a wild party. Think of a garden gathering with close friends. Epicurus's hedonism is about sustainable pleasure, the kind that nourishes the soul over a lifetime. He would gladly pass up a momentary thrill if it led to pain later, and he would even endure a little pain now if it ensured greater comfort later. This was a calculated philosophical pursuit of happiness, more about avoiding trouble than seeking orgies of delight. As he put it, every pleasure is a good thing, but not all are to be chosen. Every pain is an evil, but not all are to be avoided. Because sometimes a small pain brings a bigger benefit, and sometimes a tempting pleasure brings a bigger harm. To the extent Epicurean, today, has become associated with refined taste rather than raw debauchery, it's a bit closer to the mark. Epicurus did appreciate the finer things, like good conversation, the flavor of a simple meal when truly hungry, or the sober contemplation that makes life pleasant. But the heart of Epicureanism is not in gourmet recipes or wine pairings. It's in the insight that happiness depends on limiting our desires banishing our fears and embracing the simple, profound pleasures that remain. Epicurus spent the last decades of his life teaching and tending to his garden of friends. He suffered from ill health in his later years. It's recorded that he endured a painful struggle with kidney stones, which in those days were agonizing and hard to treat. Yet even in pain, Epicurus reportedly stayed true to his philosophy, sustaining a serene mind by recollecting the good times and insights he had shared. In 270 BC, at the age of 72, Epicurus died in Athens, reportedly cheerful to the end and surrounded by his companions. In his final letter, he is said to have thanked his friends and affirmed that the joy of remembering their conversations outweighed the physical pain of his illness, a touching real-life testament to the power of Epicurean attitude. After his death, Epicurus left instructions that his garden continue and even set up a fund to commemorate his birthday with an annual modest feast, a tradition his followers kept for centuries. The philosophy of Epicureanism did not die with Epicurus. It spread far beyond Athens. The garden in Athens continued for a couple of hundred years, and Epicurean communities sprang up all over the Hellenistic world, in Asia Minor, Syria, Egypt, and eventually in Rome itself. Alongside Stoicism, Epicureanism became one of the major schools of the late Greek and Roman era, attracting those who sought a more personal, earthly tranquility in a time of empire and uncertainty. Despite its popularity, Epicureanism eventually met resistance. As the Roman Empire became Christian, Epicurus's openly materialistic and non-religious philosophy put a target on its back. Church fathers like Lactantius and Augustine vilified Epicurus, equating his name with godlessness and immorality. They could not accept Epicurus's denial of the soul's immortality or divine judgment. By the late 4th century AD, one Christian writer declared Epicureanism extinct and its writings cold ashes. Indeed, much of Epicurus's own work was lost, likely suppressed or simply not copied by medieval scribes who saw no value in it. For many centuries, Western culture knew Epicurus mostly through secondhand accounts, often hostile. His name became a byword for heresy or hedonism in the medieval Christian imagination. Dante Alighieri, in his Divine Comedy, even placed the souls of Epicureans in a tomb in hell, punished for believing the soul dies with the body. So, from ancient Athens to Rome, and then from the Renaissance to the Enlightenment, Epicurus's influence has quietly permeated Western thought. The world's understanding of nature, the emphasis on personal happiness, the skepticism of supernatural fear-mongering, all these have a bit of Epicurus's DNA in them. Long after his critics tried to bury his legacy, Epicurus, the pleasure lover, is vindicated as Epicurus the peacebringer, the philosopher who taught us how to live without terror and love the simple things. As we conclude our journey into Epicurus's life and moral philosophy, what lessons can we take to heart today? Perhaps the most enduring insight is that happiness is attainable through attitude and understanding, not through wealth or fate. Epicurus reminds us to look at what we really need and what we can truly control. We need food, shelter, companionship, and we can control how we think about life and death. It's a message that feels surprisingly fresh in our busy, materialistic world. Slow down, don't fear the unknown. Cherish your friends and enjoy the small pleasures. In a way, Epicurus is offering permission to be content, a reassurance that it's okay to find joy in a quiet cup of tea with a friend, and to not lose sleep over cosmic mysteries. Of course, life isn't always gentle. Epicurus knew that. He felt pain. He knew turmoil in Greece. He saw friends betray each other. Yet his response was not to harden with cynicism, but to double down on rationality and kindness, pruning away the sources of suffering that could be avoided. He believed in the power of philosophy as therapy, as medicine for the soul. Think of him as an ancient life coach who says, "Don't torture yourself with irrational fears. Don't envy others or crave what you don't have. Focus on understanding the nature of things, and you will find that the natural world is enough. Pleasure is available all around you, in the breeze, in the garden, in the laughter of friends, if only you cease to disturb yourself with vain desires." It's a profoundly humanistic outlook, placing our earthly life and well-being at the center, and it has inspired generations of freethinkers and humanists since. As we sign off, imagine for a moment Epicurus's garden in its heyday. The sun is low in the sky over Athens. Inside a little walled garden, a group of friends lounges on benches or the grass. They've had a simple supper of bread, olives, and wine. Now they're engaged in light conversation. Epicurus, a kindly middle-aged man in a robe, perhaps a touch stout, is listening as two of his students discuss a puzzle about whether the soul is made of hot or cold atoms. He smiles, interjects a gentle joke, and the group chuckles. There is a deep ease in the air. No one is trying to best the other. No one is fretting about what the politicians are doing, or about angry gods hurling thunderbolts. A few garden cats weave between their legs, hoping for scraps. The night breeze is cool and carries the scent of flowers. In this little corner of the world, for this little moment, life is good and nothing is to be feared. This was Epicurus's legacy. The possibility of peace in our minds and friendship in our hearts, come what may. Thank you for joining me in exploring Epicurus's philosophy of pleasure and peace. I hope you found some wisdom in his teachings that speaks to you today. In our next episode, we'll shift gears to a very different thinker, so stay tuned for that. Until then, remember Epicurus's gentle reminder: the art of living well and the art of living happily are one. Be well, and goodbye for now.